and the last, do we have another caller? No, no. Okay, good. Because we're almost out of time. I want to thank Sarah and Lou of Portland Great Panthers. You can reach them at, the phone number is?
503-222-2974.
Excellent, excellent. Stay tuned for their action this Friday, February 14th, 12 to 2 p.m. at the Portland Building. And I appreciate you all for coming here and making it through. And I want to thank Danielle for being our special engineer this morning. You have been listening to More Talk Radio on your community radio station, KBOO-FM. I am Cecil Prescott. Thank you so much. Remain faithful in your commitment to justice and peace, and all will be well. Thank you. Take care of yourself.
Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning, I'm Fran Michelle, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station, which you can support by clicking on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app, or by texting KBOO to 44321, or by snail mailing your support to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. On today's episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour, we hear about resistance and resilience, law and labor, books and movies. In light of the multiple airplane collisions in the U.S. in the past couple of weeks, I have a commentary on the 1981 strike by the air traffic controllers of PATCO. Jan Hocken talks with Senegalese filmmaker Moussa Sen Absa, who will be appearing later this week, along with three of his films, at the Cascade Festival of African Films. Bookmole Patricia Kullberg reviews the ethnography Bad Boys, Public Schools in the Making of Black Masculinity by Anne Arnett Ferguson. And we'll hear from Lisa Kwan of the Oregon ACLU and Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland about their request for records of the surveillance of Oregonians by federal police. As ever, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show and that red Donate tab in the upper right corner to help support local, independent media. In case you missed it, last week KBOO offered a statement that reads, in part, quote, "In light of the inauguration, the slew of executive orders, and the rise of misinformation in the United States, we here at KBOO are committed to continuing our legacy as an alternative to mainstream media. We have a duty to serve our community by bringing you accurate information, by giving space to underrepresented voices, and by uplifting arts and culture. In these uncertain times, KABU seeks to be a guiding light for those who are scared, those who are affected, and those who are fighting the good fight. KABU stands with the immigrant community, the LGBTQIA+ community, the disability community, and all of those affected by the new administration. End quote. Brothers, sisters, we don't read that Bible's proofing. Brothers, sisters, we don't read that Bible's proofing. That was a bit of the group Heaven 17 performing their 1981 song, We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thang, a sentiment that still rings true. Right now, as I compose this, we still don't fully know what caused the mid-air collision over Washington, D.C. at the end of January. But Donald Trump didn't let the lack of information stop him from immediately blaming diversity, equity, and inclusion. That is, as Jamal Bowie and others have noted, he's blaming black people, and other people of color, and women, and people with disabilities, and others who have historically been excluded from power or from the recognition of their merit, as part of his project to resegregate the federal government and the nation. In response to those comments, the president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, NATCA, stressed the rigorous training standards all certified controllers must meet, and said, quote, "The proud men and women that comprise the national aviation safety professionals bear the immense responsibility of ensuring the safety and efficiency of the national airspace system while working short-staffed, often 6 days a week, and in facilities long overdue for modernization," end quote. Short staffing, long hours, and outdated facilities have been recognized as problems for years. 2 years ago, the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, held a safety summit prompted by a string of near misses during takeoff and landing. A 2023 study by the Department of Transportation Inspector General's Office found that less than 1% of FAA facilities were fully staffed, and over three-quarters of the busiest sites were critically understaffed. The FAA had no plan to address the staffing shortage and instead was mandating extended overtime just to maintain that inadequate staffing. In 2024, the General Accounting Office, the GAO, reported that most of the FAA's equipment was becoming unsustainable because of underfunding and lack of maintenance. The New York Times has reported that congressional lawmakers have repeatedly added more flights to the DC airport, despite repeated warnings that it would increase the risk of accidents. And despite the longtime understaffing of air traffic control, all controllers last month received Elon Musk's deceptive letter prompting federal workers to resign. So these problems, understaffing, overwork, inadequate equipment, poor administration, and terrible morale, have been getting worse. But they are not new. Indeed, they sound a lot like the problems that prompted the air traffic controllers' strike of 1981, which turned out to be a key event in labor history. As historian Joseph McCartan tells it in his 2011 book, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America, air traffic controllers had been demanding changes for years before they managed in 1968 to organize PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. The 1970s were an era of rank-and-file action in the United States, with over 5,000 work stoppages involving 3 million workers just in 1970 alone. The number of unionized workers reached an all-time high in 1979. And although strikes by government unions were technically illegal, several had managed to declare strikes without incurring penalties. As a PATCO slogan had it, "There are no illegal strikes, just unsuccessful ones." When PATCO began contract negotiations with the FAA in early 1981, their demands included reduced hours and increased pay, but also, centrally, included demands for better safety, increased staffing, improved equipment, and changes in FAA management. The mere threat of a strike won them some concessions, but the membership wanted more. They believed they could get it, and they voted to strike. I had a cousin who was an air traffic controller at the time, and what I recall hearing from him was not about pay, but about stress and safety, understaffing and overwork. 90% of air traffic controllers left the job before retirement age, half of them seeking medical care for stress-related illnesses. In 1978, President Carter had overseen the deregulation of the airline industry, which led to a huge expansion in the number of flights. Patco had actually endorsed Ronald Reagan for president, perhaps because he had been no obstacle to a firefighter strike when he was governor of California. But this time, Reagan invoked the Taft-Hartley Act to declare the strike illegal, giving workers 48 hours to return to work or be fired. But the strike was unsuccessful in winning popular support or shutting down air travel. Patco had failed to build solidarity in the community or across unions. In the past, they had crossed the lines of other airline unions, and their strike was not supported by airline pilots or other airport workers, or by the AFL-CIO. As Justin Harrison describes it in an article on Socialist Alternative, a small but significant minority of controllers crossed the picket line, and by using supervisors, scabs, and military controllers, the FAA was able to keep traffic at 60% of pre-strike levels. In order to break the union, the FAA kept the planes flying without regard for public safety. When the 48-hour ultimatum expired, Reagan fired over 11,000 strikers, permanently replacing them with managers and military controllers, and banning them from ever working for the federal government again. Federal marshals and the FBI were used to hunt down strikers. Their phones were tapped and their families harassed. Strikers were arrested, fined, and jailed. The union strike fund was seized by the courts, and the union decertified. Replacing striking workers had been legal since 1938, though employers had rarely done it. But Reagan's strike-breaking gave employers the green light, and in the decade following the Patco strike, private employers increasingly replaced workers or threatened to do so. Major strikes involving more than 1,000 workers declined precipitously in the next decade, from an average of 300 every year throughout the 70s to just 16 annually by the 2010s. Since strikes are a major tool for workers to exert power, this contributed to the decline in real wages and thus to the explosion of income and wealth inequality. As McCartan has argued in recent articles following up on his 2011 book, Reagan's crushing of the Patco strike and the neoliberal attack on public services he helped spearhead has had broad political consequences. McCartan notes that the Patco debacle disabled what was once a vital instrument for building and maintaining social solidarity and for directing inevitable class tensions and social conflict toward democratic and egalitarian ends. The continued erosion of a robust tradition of workers' collective action left a power vacuum that encouraged white supremacy and the January 6th insurrection in 2021, and that now threatens the functioning of government. The exercise of workers' collective power is central to public safety, in transportation, but also in the safety of our water and food, breathable air and public health, and more. It's also central to resisting the resegregation of America and to moving us back toward the democratic and egalitarian aims that have been a long-standing, if never yet achieved, aspiration of people in the United States. It takes time and organizing and solidarity to build a successful strike. But the number of strikes in the U.S. has been increasing in recent years, and increasingly drawing on the model of bargaining for the common good, building solidarity with communities as well as other workers. The United Auto Workers have called for unions to align their contract expirations for May 1, 2028. Conversations moving toward this alignment are reportedly in the works among the rank and file in unions of teachers, postal workers, electrical workers, healthcare workers, and more. Calls for a general strike in the U.S. are building. And although it's an ambitious goal, it's commensurate with the challenges we face. So keep supporting all the workers you know and are and depend on. Walk the picket lines, don't cross them. Get active in your union, or join a socialist organization, or read up on labor history. Do what you can. We are all on a collision course. Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing. That, again, was Heaven 17 performing their song We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing, which came out earlier the same year as Ronald Reagan crushed the Patco strike. I'm Fran Michel, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Later on today's show, we'll hear Patricia Kullberg reviewing Portlander Ann Ferguson's study of how public schools disservice black boys, and how those boys negotiate and maneuver within those racist power structures in order to maintain a sense of self-worth and dignity. We'll also hear from Lisa Kwan of the Oregon ACLU and Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland about maneuvering for information about police surveillance of anti-racist protesters and other activists. We turn now to uplifting some arts and culture. The Cascade Festival of African Films runs through March 1st in celebration of Black History Month at Portland Community College, with all screenings free and open to the public. This year, the Centerpiece Weekend features the artistry and presence of acclaimed Senegalese filmmaker Moussa Sen Abse. Here he is in conversation with the Old Mole's Jan Hocken.
I'm talking this morning with Moussa Sen Abse, an internationally recognized Senegalese film director, screenwriter, painter, and songwriter, perhaps best known for his trilogy of films that are screening at the Cascade Festival of African Films here in Portland this month. The retrospective of his work opens with the screening on February 14th of Hale, which was the 2022 Oscar submission by Senegal to the 95th Academy Awards for Best International Feature Film. Well, welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour, Moussa Sen Abse.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be programmed in this wonderful festival and to show this trilogy of my films, starting with Tableau Ferraille in 97 and Madame Brouet 2002, and then 20 years later, Hale. Hale is the story.
It's a kind of love letter to the women in your life and your country of Senegal, is it not? I mean, and in that sense, yes. It's maybe a great Valentine. That's Valentine's Day here, so it's your own Valentine in a way.
Yes.
Well, tell us about the film. The film, the basic story. It's a richly engaging, a beautifully realized film, visually, musically, dramatically. Tell us about it and your vision of that most recent film.
Oh, Hale came out because of, every day I was just looking at the newspapers and I was seeing so many scandals about young girls raped by their family member, by school teachers, by neighbors. And so I was very confused about this phenomenon. And I was just asking myself, so how come that these stories are so recurrent, so coming back and forth every day? And then I start to look at my society and ask questions with psychologists, with doctors and family members and inside my family too, just asking questions. And then it comes out that so many dramas are boiling in families in silence, and there are so many victims that are very silent about it, and nobody was talking about it. So this is the base of the seed of the story. And of course, for me, it's a big drama for young girls being raped, but it's a social drama. It's not only about the girl, it's also about the whole society, how the society reacts about these kind of elements that destroy your society.
I think your film so effectively draws out how many people are implicated in the troubles of this girl and her abuse.
Because, in our society, the individual has a sense regarding the community. And the individual doesn't exist without the community. So the community is very involved in the individual part of a person. So I was very, very scared because I have daughters also. So I was also asking my daughters what happened in their life. So from questioning the society, questioning people, girls, men, women, elders, I was just, digging more and more and finding out a line of storytelling. And I ended up writing Hale, which is the story of these twins having two different paths in their life and also trying to heal their wounds, because as some French psychologist was saying, is that we spend our life trying to heal the wounds of our childhood, because we have scars, we have wounds, you know, we are going through the path of the life, and during this path, sometimes you hit your head on something, you bleed, and then this element become kind of a scar that makes your life different. So
yeah,
I always think that it's very important for me. It was very important for me to tell such a story.
Yeah, and I'm a psychologist myself, and I've been interested as a psychologist in how films portray the abuse and trauma of women. And one thing I very much appreciated about your film was that you didn't pull away from the abuse she suffered from her uncle, but she also continued to live her life. She had support. She was not defeated by this. Without giving too much away, there's a revenge element to the story where she fights back, but she's a single woman who raises a daughter, and so she's a defiant young woman who is not defeated by this abuse. Can you say something about that portrayal? Because sometimes I think abusive victims are portrayed as completely defeated and so injured they cannot function. But she was a very, you know, she had a life that continued, even though she ends up exacting revenge on this man.
You know, I have been raised by women, and all the women I knew in my childhood was very strong, and many of them were having very difficult stories, but at the same time they have always this beautiful smile in their face. They danced, they were singers, they were so beautiful, and I was always asking myself, so what makes them alive after all this trauma that they have been passing through? The trauma of divorce, trauma of losing a man. One of them was a widow. One of them had so many troubles with a man and ended up being divorced. And still, they enjoyed life. They were just so beautiful, so full of life. And I always think that I always thought that this is a kind of a tribute I have to make for women regarding these ones that have been all around me, because I was the only child of my mom. I have a brother, but the brother was not with my mom. So I was with my mom, and my mom didn't have any daughters. So I was the daughter of my mom.
Yeah.
I was doing all these jobs that a daughter had to do for the family. I was cooking, I was cleaning, I was ironing, I was washing, I was doing all these things. So at the end of the day,
that gave you an appreciation for women's work.
Yes, and at the end, these women were looking at me like a little daughter. So they didn't hide to me. They were telling their stories, and I was sitting there, and I was listening. And this makes these are the fundamentals of my narration.
And you also have this interesting narrative device in the film that has been called Afro-Greek chorus. Mm-hmm. Is that part of what you're describing as the voices of others that kind of encircle the person, the protagonist, a kind of both guiding spirits, guiding voices, and also the observers of what is happening that helps the audience understand, like the Greek chorus? Can you say a little bit about that device in your film?
You know, this device is a very traditional way of storytelling. These women that were surrounding me were singers. They were singing during baptism, during funerals, during weddings, and they can sing a person like a long story. So it's not a Greek kind of thing. It's an African way of of storytelling.
Yeah.
And my approach is that, you know, as we are not alone, we have our spirit, we have our soul, we have our body. We are inside of a society, and the society has a voice. Our body has a voice. Our soul as a voice. So these characters that are the lines of storytelling in my films are the poets, the philosopher, this spirit that is surrounding our life, because there is no moment of silence in an individual. Even if you sleep, you know, there is no silence. You know, your spirit is always occupied by something about dreams.
Right, the voices of you know. Others. And psychologists yes. talk about that as well, the inner voice, okay. the guiding voices.
These voices for me are very important. So when I write, first of all, I write the music before I write the film, which is a very strange way. People always ask me, my producers especially, they always ask me, so how come that you want to make the music before the film? I say the music is the line of my story. It's a long poem I write. It can be like 20 pages of poetry that I put in music. And these lines of poetry sustain the narrative that I want to tell. And the music is part of my... I come from a griot family, you know. My family is a griot family. And we are storytellers, we are singers.
Is that a tribe or group within that
group.
West Africa, that an ethnic group that has a particular aesthetic around music?
Yes, yes. The griots are the memory of the society. They are also those who are putting the bridges when there is a problem. They call the griot to resolve these problems. So they are also judges. You know, they are kind of people that help the society to be peaceful, to be in harmony. And I always remember one of my aunt. I called her the lawyer, because sometimes there is a problem in a couple, and they call her. And she would say to me, "Come, Musa, come with me." So I was just sitting there and listening to her, how she can bridge this broken bridge, you know, how she can rely all these dots that was sparkling all over the place, and you know, and becomes a big drama. And they just, I mean, she was just talking, and at the end, these people just hug each other, you know. And I was thinking to myself, but she's a great lawyer. She's a great prosecutor or a magistrate, you know.
And at the end, for me, that without giving, I don't want to give away the end of the film, but the film ends with a scene of women, magistrates or judges who are hearing a case. And I don't want any spoilers, but were you saying something as you concluded the film about this community of women judges who they're the arbitrators who seem
yes.
to be sympathetic, but it's left kind of open, the ending?
Yes, because you know, I don't want to be I don't want to be a moralist, you know. I don't have the solution. I just open doors, you know, and put the curtain. So you open the curtain, you open the door, you enter, and you find your own way. So
it invites the audience. I watched the film with my husband, and we had a discussion about the ending of the film. And I think that's good. While I still have you, I would like you to say a little bit about the twin brother, because it's about the path of the young woman, the girl Awa, and she's a student, has aspirations, works in her aunt's salon after school. The boy is really determined to go to Europe and is kind of smitten, entranced by the fantasy of becoming rich in Europe, going to Paris. So the film, in a way, is also a cautionary tale or commentary on the fantasy of immigration that captures so many young people in Africa. What were you trying to say in the film about that fantasy?
You know that passports exist only at the beginning of the 19th century. Before, people were just like going from one place to another without any problem.
So the whole idea of having papers depends on when those papers started.
And you know, it's in the human nature to travel. to discover other land, other people. I always think that the world is completely closed, and this aspect of the world brings so much trauma and drama. And I will just say, everybody has to dream. The dream is priceless. You know, you need to have vision. You need to have any kind of perspective that sweet in your face and on your path. So Adama, like many African boys, look at the world as a big place to go. And unfortunately or fortunately, they all want to see something else. And I think this is human. But at the same time, it is so difficult for them to get visa, to get paper, to get that. So they just decide sometimes to take a boat. And since long time, I live in front of the sea. And I look at the sea now like a big cemetery, you know, which is dramatic for me because I love the sea. Because so many young boys and girls are drawn in the Atlantic Ocean or in the Mediterranean Ocean. And I think that's not fair, because I think the world would be better if everybody can go wherever he or she feel like going.
Yeah. So you were not condemning that curiosity and impulse to see a bigger world, even though many, as you say, are lost and swallowed up in that sea, but through forces that are unnecessary and are the product of the history of colonialism and imperialism, that so many goods travel in the global economy as people are stopped at the borders.
You know, it's an advocacy for an open world, open humanity.
A world without world without borders.
A world without borders. Because when you put borders, you block others to meet others.
Yeah.
You know, and I believe in the Ubuntu. I am because you are. If we can meet in a point, then we can exchange. Then we can learn more about each other. Then we can be better. We can be better human. And more we are better human, more the world will be beautiful. So maybe it's an utopic, idealistic view, but I believe in utopia.
We need utopias. And I think that's a beautiful note to conclude on and to remind listeners that this is the 35th annual festival, Cascade Festival of African Films, that is very much in the spirit that you described so eloquently, a world without borders where we can learn about Africa through African eyes rather than through the common distortions of Western commercial cinema. So we're so delighted that you'll be joining us here in Portland. You'll be at the Hollywood Theater to speak with audiences after the screening Friday evening, February 14th, the Hala film. And it's free. All the films that are supported by Portland Community College are free and open to the public, which is very unique to be able to go to all of these beautiful films for free. In closing, can you say what you'll be doing? Briefly, the other two films in the retrospective of your work that will be screening the following day and evening, February 15th at the Cascade Campus of Portland Community College. Just say a bit in closing about those other two films.
These two films are very important for me, because the first one, Tableau Ferraille, is about love, and it's also about women who can't have children. And in my community, it's a very difficult issue. The second one, Tableau Ferraille, is about loneliness and how love is important in life, and how you can be in a society where the patriarchal system is also blocking so many women initiatives. And all these three films have something in common, is women destiny. I will end up saying one word, which is, you know, in the world, the world is working with only one leg. And there is another leg, which is missing. And this leg is women in Africa.
Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor and a hopeful one about the interdependence That we are definitely all interdependent men and women, and the West is most surely dependent on Africa and has a lot to learn from all of the countries and rich traditions of Africa. Well, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Jan Hawken, talking today with Moussa Sen Absa, Senegalese film director, painter, songwriter, artist, who will be here for his trilogy of films. It's a special retrospective that is part of the Cascade Festival of African Films. Go on the website to see the full program. It's a month of fabulous films, and we look forward to welcoming you soon to the City of Roses, Portland.
Thank you, and I will bring some paintings, and I will paint there, so you will have the opportunity to see my paintings too.
Oh, I would love that. I look forward to seeing you soon. Take care, travel safe.
Thank you, dear. Thank you very much.
That was some of the tune Griots by Moussa Sen Absa, and before that, the composer, writer, painter, and filmmaker himself, in conversation with Jan Hawken. I'm Fran Michel, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next up, we hear from book mole Patricia Kullberg.
The minute they see me, fear me, I'm the epitome, a public enemy, use the fuse without clues, I refuse to blow a fuse, they even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype!
The music you just heard is from Don't Believe the Hype by Public Enemy. It's with these lyrics that Anne Ferguson opens her book titled Bad Boys, Public Schools in the Making of Black Masculinity. Ferguson is Associate Professor Emeritus of Afro-American Studies, Smith College. The words capture two prevailing images in the U.S., the black man as a fearsome criminal, and the black man as an endangered species, used and abused. Ferguson's project, through ethnographic study, is to uncover the role of public schools in this making of the black man. In her own words, it is an account of the power of institutions to create, shape, and regulate social identities. The book, originally published in 2000, is considered a classic text. In 2021, it was reissued with a new bibliographic essay by Ferguson. Sadly, what it reveals about black boys and schooling changed very little during the two intervening decades. Black boys fare so poorly in the public school systems of this country that we talk about their experience as a school-to-prison pipeline. Ferguson set out to understand how that worked, to learn about black boys. What very often happened instead is that she learned from black boys. It is Horace, for example, who points out that she will understand nothing about him and his friends if she did not listen to their music. Horace is 12 years old, a so-called troublemaker and a negative standard, as reflected in teachers' comments like, so-and-so is a problem, but he's no Horace. Ferguson, however, finds Horace to be bright and socially sophisticated. Through him, she comes to see the kids as, quote, resourceful social actors who took an active role in shaping their daily experiences, who devise strategies for negotiating and maneuvering within structures of power. At Rosa Parks Elementary in Oakland, where Ferguson hangs out for 3+ years, kids are evaluated and sorted into the various rungs of a social hierarchy. Ferguson draws on radical schooling theory to illustrate the hidden curriculum that, quote, reflects the cultural hegemony of the dominant class and works to reinforce and reproduce that dominance by exacerbating and multiplying, rather than diminishing or eliminating, the inequalities children bring from home or neighborhood to school. Ferguson shows how classifying the kids takes place primarily through punishment. The teachers, both black and white, well-meaning and sometimes ambivalent, nonetheless actively collude in the process. Ironically, it is the black educators who most strictly enforce the repression of black speech, yet another denigration of black culture and identity. Black boys are pushed to derace themselves, to camouflage themselves through acting white. At the same time, black children, as opposed to the white students, are adultified. It is not childhood exuberance behind their misbehavior, but something more adult and sinister. Furthermore, the mistakes they make are viewed as individual choices and rarely as the result of a broader and racist social context that diminishes their lives and opportunities. Much of Ferguson's book focuses on the school from the point of view of the black boys and how they configure themselves as black and male in a space where they are seen as problems or failures. Ferguson finds that the school day for the kids is, quote, tedious, interminable, and kills any creative impulse. Getting into trouble is a way to make the day more interesting. For a black boy, it's also a way to make a reputation. Reggie is a kid who disrupts the class, and he brags about it to Ferguson, quote, the teacher says, and he mimics a high-pitched, fussy voice, you not the teacher of this class. And then I say, he adopts a sprightly, cheeky tone, oh, yes, I am. Then she say, no, you're not, and if you got a problem, you can just leave. I say, okay, and leave, end quote. Ferguson points out that these theatrics not only help Reggie distinguish himself within the classroom, but also work to challenge adult power in ways that can expose its chinks and weaknesses. The bad boys, she writes, are astute observers. They are aware of the ranking and labeling and critically reflect on the process itself. They draw on community and family-derived perspectives to create a different narrative about themselves other than man-boys who are headed for prison. It's a process that necessarily involves a de-identification with the school and active not learning as a strategy to create and preserve a sense of self that is more congruent with their own communities. Bad Boys is an academic text, but it is highly readable. Ferguson writes with considerable humility, grace, and erudition. She includes a generous sampling of her field notes, which bring to life the points she is making. I found that some of the most delightful passages involve reflections on her own behavior. She writes about the time, for example, when she gets caught up in surreptitious communication with a boy named Chris, about how to construct what are called cootie catchers. While the teacher drones on, Chris signals her how to make one. They go back and forth until Ferguson realizes that she's engaged in a thrilling complicity to break the rules. Despite the momentary thrills, Ferguson's story is heartbreaking. Horace, she notes in her introduction to the reissued text, once her intelligent guide to a black boy's world, has been in and out of jail since his youth, and may very well be headed for San Quentin. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking about the book by Ann Ferguson called Bad Boys, Public Schools in the Making of Black Masculinity.
Come on! Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how. Some people never know. The enemy could be the friend guardian. I'm not a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist. Preach to teach the
officer. Cause some they never had this.
Number one, never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
That was Don't Believe the Hype by Public Enemy. And before that, Patricia Kohlberg reviewing Ann Ferguson's book, Bad Boys, Public Schools in the Making of Black Masculinity. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and for our last segment, we'll share a conversation that I had with Lisa Kwan of the Oregon ACLU and Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland. Last month, the ACLU of Oregon and Don't Shoot Portland partnered to file three public records requests with the City of Portland, the Oregon Department of Justice, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. In each case, the request is seeking information about the extent to which the Portland Police Bureau or the Oregon Titan Fusion Center or the Portland FBI Field Office, respectively, monitors and collects information on people engaged in protest activity and/or associate protest with terrorism, and whether their privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties protections are adequate to guard against abuses and discrimination. To talk about these filings, I want to welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour Lisa Kwan, a legal associate with the ACLU of Oregon.
Hi, happy to be here. Thank you.
And Teresa Rayford, the founder of Don't Shoot Portland.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So can you tell us how and why these record requests came about?
Yes. So first off, we have known that law enforcement agencies participate in unlawful surveillance of people, especially people of color across the U.S. And so this is not our first public records request to state agencies in Oregon. But this specific series of requests were actually modeled after ACLU nationals. FOIA requests, which stands for the Freedom of Information Act, seeking records on the use of JTTFs and fusion centers on the national level. And they actually failed to receive the records and ended up filing a lawsuit in July of last year, which is still ongoing. And so in Oregon, we wanted to do something similar, but for state law enforcement. So we, again, like you said, filed records requests to the City of Portland, Oregon Department of Justice, and the Portland FBI Field Office, seeking records from 2017 to now. And really, we just want to find records related to policy procedures and guidelines and agreements between federal, state, and local agencies to understand how they work together, what triggers this collaboration, how the data collected is stored and protected, and then actual surveillance records of individuals that have engaged in protest. And this is why we wanted to partner with Don't Shoot Portland, because their community members have been targeted by police due to, you know, social justice and activism work. So I'll pass it to Teresa to provide more context there.
Absolutely. Yeah. When we were organizing, and we'll go as early as 2014 through 2017, a lot of times we would realize that in our organizing spaces, and as well as in any rallying or event spaces, that there would be a concentration of law enforcement. I remember one time getting to a space and they had like selfie sticks with cameras on them. And we were like, hey, are you like monitoring us? Are you recording us? Like, what's going on? I know you're not violating our right to free speech. Like, what are you doing here? And so just realizing that that was happening, and then where we are now in the world, you know, being concerned, being informed is most important. We don't want to assume anything, but we would like to know what's happening and how we're, you know, how we're being investigated, if we're being investigated, and really what that would look like in the future. Obviously, there's a lot of federal agencies that are being investigated and their information is being shared and publicly. And if we have been investigated in any way, and if there's information that could possibly be shared, it'd be better for us to know ahead of time so that we can do things that we need to do to protect ourselves.
So the police clearly have been monitoring groups protesting and intervening, probably keeping records that we don't know about. Can you say a little bit more about what the JTTF is and the Oregon Titan Fusion Center? I mean, why these particular organizations or agencies?
Definitely. So JTTF stand for Joint Terrorism Task Force, and they are FBI operated. And so it's a partnership between federal, state, and local law enforcement that supposedly conduct terrorism investigations, among other things. And then fusion centers are run by the Department of Homeland Security, and they operate in every state in the US. And they especially, you know, started growing in the aftermath of 9/11. And we know that Muslim communities were one of the first communities to be the target of racial profiling in the name of counterterrorism by these fusion centers. And so in Oregon, we have one called the Titan Fusion Center, and it's housed under the Oregon Department of Justice Criminal Division. And according to their website, they investigate outside of terrorism as well and gathers information related to like all crimes and hazards. So it's unclear what the parameters are and, you know, what they do outside of terrorism. And also, we don't know what their terrorism work also means. And again, with JTTFs, we also have a very limited understanding of how they work with local law enforcement. But we do have an understanding that JTTFs operate with the Oregon State Police, Multnomah County, Washington County and Clackamas County, and the city of Portland in some capacity. But again, we just don't know how these collaborations work. And another thing we're concerned about is one of Trump's recent executive orders directing the Department of Homeland Security task forces to enforce his mass deportation plan and how JTTFs will then be utilized on the local level. So we've also submitted, since these three public records requests, another to Clackamas County to really understand their partnership with JTTF and how this partnership will exist in the broader context of immigration. So there's a lot of moving parts to, you know, these collaborations that we really want to find out more about.
My understanding is that the Portland police chief has recently reassured the public that Portland police, even when they're working with JTTF, they don't engage in immigration actions. But it's not clear that they might not be doing that if JTTF says, this person is a terrorist and they just happen to be an immigrant. So those parameters are not really clear to the public, at least. And I take it those are some of the questions you're seeking to have answered.
Exactly.
So it's my understanding that the JTTF in Portland is required to present a report every year about their activities by the end of January. And this year's report is going to be presented in the next couple of weeks. What kind of information are you asking for instance, from the Portland Police Bureau about their JTTF activities that's maybe not covered in those yearly reports?
Yeah, thank you. We know that the city of Portland withdrew from working with JTTF in 2019, but it's very unclear to us on how they are still collaborating because we know that they still do. And so while we look forward to reviewing the report that you mentioned, we believe that our records request, it's broader than what the Portland City or the Portland Police Bureau is required to report back this year. So again, we're asking for certain keywords. We're asking for records that go back to 2017. And again, just more on the broader procedures and agreements between the city and JTTF that we don't have. And so we're hoping that these requests will bring to light the more broader questions that we have.
Apparently, according to Oregon law, you should have gotten responses to these requests by now, but that hasn't happened. Is that the case?
We have gotten emails that our records request was received, but it does, you know, it is a process. One of our records requests was to the FBI. So we actually did have to submit a records request to the FBI, which, you know, outside of Oregon. So that one was denied. So we do plan to appeal that. And then we are waiting to hear back from the city of Portland. And then we recently met with the Fusion Center team under the Department of Justice just to answer some follow-up questions. So we expect a lot of documents. So it will also take some time for us to go through them and, you know, analyze information.
And my understanding is that assuming you do get all of that information that you've requested, you will then be making it available to the public so that people can know what kinds of surveillance and data is being kept on them.
Yes, correct.
What are some things that people might do in terms of helping the requests, encouraging responses, or perhaps defending ourselves against surveillance by the current administration and these law enforcement agencies?
Yeah, thank you for this question. I think it's very timely. So first, we encourage the public to just stay tuned on this specific public records request project. We will, like you said, be making what we find out public. We also, on our website at the ACLU of Oregon, have a section where folks can submit their own public records requests. So we have a guide. So if you suspect, you know, that law enforcement has been surveilling you, there's a guide on how you can submit your own. We also really encourage the public to educate themselves and community members on knowing your rights. So again, if you go on our website, we have a Know Your Rights tab for immigrants, protesting and free speech, and for students. And so, again, we really want to emphasize the importance of knowing your rights and also getting involved in volunteering in your community, like with organizations like Don't Shoot Portland. But specifically with this records request, we encourage you to follow us on our social media and email list so you can stay up to date on what we find. What about you, Teresa?
I want to encourage everybody that if you feel like you've been surveyed or investigated or anyone's watching you, to, again, follow up with the ACLU, fill out that form and utilize this opportunity while we still have the right to do it, because with so many things changing and so many executive orders and departments closing, my thought in this reality is that we are filing these requests, but who's going to be there to do the reporting or the research if everything continues to get shut down and if staff is continued to, you know, be forced to resign? So I think that, you know, we're in a crisis. We've been in a crisis. We wouldn't have been in the streets for over a decade saying Black Lives Matter if we didn't believe that we were in crisis mode. And now we need the information that will help us assist our communities in being safe, because speaking up should never be considered terrorism in America, not with our First Amendment right to free speech.
Thank you both so much for talking with the Old Mole Variety Hour today about these requests by the ACLU of Oregon and Don't Shoot Portland for information about law enforcement surveillance of protesters and people exercising their First Amendment rights in Oregon. Thank you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
No cops, no KKK, no fascist USA. No war, no KKK, no fascist USA. No Trump, no KKK, fascist USA. You know I'm born to die, I'm born to cry. Let me have cake to my outrage. Misunderstood, do what I could.
That was MDC performing Born to Die. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and I've been your host today. Thanks very much to today's guests, Lisa Kwan of the Oregon ACLU and Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland, for talking with me about their efforts to find out how federal police have been keeping tabs on Oregonians. Thanks to Patricia Culbert for her review of Bad Boys, Public Schools in the Making of Black Masculinity by Ann Arnett Ferguson. Thanks to Jan Hocken and her guest, Musa Sen Abza, for their conversation about his films playing this week at the Cascade Festival of African Films. Thanks to Joe Clement for playing our theme song, and thanks to Tom Becker for behind-the-scenes help. Thanks very much to all the members who already support KBOO, and thanks to the volunteers and staff who keep alive our beloved community, especially in these difficult times. You can find audio for The Old Mole, as well as links to more information about our segments, including information about knowing your rights and seeing more movies, on our website at kboo.org.
anchor.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show, and you can use the red Donate tab in the upper right corner to support your nonprofit independent community radio station. We'll also post on the page for today's show information about some other upcoming events and resources, including links to ways to support workers at Starbucks, New Seasons, Portland State University, and Providence Health and Services. On Friday, February 14th, the Deportation Defense Coalition will be building community solidarity to protect our immigrant neighbors from 12 to 2 p.m. at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth Street. And they remind you that if someone you know is being detained by ICE, you can call the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition hotline any day at 1-800-622-1510. Next week, Thursday, February 20th, there will be a huge Rumble on the River community forum about four current issues: PGE's proposed intrusion into Forest Park, Point Westward plans for a massive refinery and rail yard in the Columbia River estuary, Zenith Energy's expansion schemes, and the surge of AI and data centers threatening Oregon's 45-year-old anti-nuclear law. Doors open at 5:30 at St. Luke Lutheran Church, 4595 Southwest California Street in Portland, Thursday, February 20th. You can watch Jan Hawkins' film, Atomic Bamboozle, for free all of this month through a collaboration with the Oregon Conservancy Foundation, which has information about a raft of scary pro-nuclear bills. And remember, unmasked in-person events risk spreading dangerous illnesses, even from people who don't feel any symptoms themselves. But respirator masks really bug the right wing, so irritate the fascists and protect your comrades by wearing an N95. Contact Mass Block PDX for more information. The Old Mole will be back next Monday morning at 9 a.m. Stay tuned to KBOO Now for Locus Focus, with Barbara Bernstein talking with Breach Collective lawyer Nick Caleb about what options remain for finally shutting down Zenith Energy. We'll go out with more of Musa Sen Absa's griots.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And this coming Thursday on Words and Pictures, we're talking Democracy Under Siege with filmmaker Laura Nix and political cartoonist Ann Telness. Ann Telness recently